I'm unusually excited about this topic. I mean, to be honest, I'm usually excited about all the topics, but this one is, in a sense, more present than some, because, it's just very recent, and because it partly involves a celebration of my first novel, which is not scheduled to be published until September. And we'll go into all of that in just a moment. But first, I want you to just find a place to sit that's comfortable. And just allow yourself to become aware I want you to allow yourself to become aware of the way that you are currently experiencing yourself in this room. So you've got your eyes closed. And just notice how you experience yourself sitting on the chair, if you hear noises in the room, you can place them. You can still imagine what the room looks like. You can feel your hands on your knees, if they are on your knees. You can feel your feet on the floor, maybe. You can hear the vent overhead. You kind of imagine the ceiling up there. The chairs around you. It's pretty easy to sit here and be aware of yourself in the room. Know where you're situated. Know how your body is positioned. Know what's around you. Now I want you to continue to pay attention to all the sensations, but to stop knowing what they are. Stop defining them as anything. So maybe you feel your hands in your lap, but can you let go of knowing that you are feeling your hands in your lap, and instead just feel the raw, uninterpreted sensation? Can you hear the air blowing through the vent and let go of knowing that it's air blowing through a vent. And just hear it as a vibration without knowing what it is. Can you let go of knowing that the air vent is overhead? Can you just hear it as everywhere? Can you let go of knowing that your hands are in your lap? And can you feel that sensation of contact everywhere? Take a moment to let go of all knowing and just experience the sensation of this moment without having any idea what any of it is. Okay, great. Thank you. So, were any of you able, to some degree at least, to let go of all the knowing and just experience the sensation? If you were, you can just let me know. A tiny bit. Maybe a little, some more so. Okay. It's difficult. You know those optical illusions where you get it and you don't, you know, they say there's something in there, but you don't, you know. They used to, remember those, the kind of interesting, almost three-dimensional ones, magic something, and it just looks like these colored, and it says there's a horse in there, and you look at it, and you look at it, and you squint your eyes, but if you keep looking, at some point you see it. I don't know how that works, but they were really popular at one point. And once you see it, then it's hard to unsee it. You know, before, you know, it's very frustrating, it takes you forever, and you find it very difficult to see, but once you see it the first time, it's very hard to unsee it. So, like, there's that famous black and white one of something that looks like a goblet, and then someone tells you that it's actually two people talking, you know, and you've just reversed the image. And once you see it that way, it's very difficult to not see it. Even though there was a certain amount of time when all you saw was a goblet and it was driving you crazy. But once you saw the faces, it was very hard to unsee them. Just give people a minute to sit. There's chairs on this side, actually. You can walk right around. Or you can pull out more chairs. So, generally speaking, the reason why I do and teach more or less everything that I do and teach is because we live in a situation that's a little bit like one of those pictures. And the language that I like to use is that we live inside of a paradigm. And a paradigm is a foundational way of defining reality that we then live inside of. And once you live inside it, and once you're trained to see it that way, it gets very, very difficult to see it any other way. In fact, almost impossible, really. And for reasons that we'll go into in a few minutes, not only is it just difficult to see it any other way, but we live in a culture that almost does everything it possibly can to ensure that you won't see it any other way. Essentially by threatening you with being labeled crazy if you say that you do. That's essentially the way the dominant paradigm works. Once it becomes dominant, it then defines itself as reality and all other alternatives as crazy. And so anyone who claims to see a different alternative is labeled as crazy. Now, the unfortunate part about the picture is just the fact that you see an alternative doesn't necessarily make you sane either. If that were true, then this would be very simple, but it's not quite that simple. So what I'm interested in, you know, when I teach meditation or I teach philosophy, or like tonight when we're going to speak about writing and science fiction and spiritual awakening, I'm interested in how we can see beyond and, yeah, beyond the current paradigm. How can we see a different picture? So the fundamental way that I personally like to imagine reality being is that there is some underlying energetic dynamic occurring, and that underlying energetic dynamic could be interpreted many different ways, and we live in a paradigm that has a certain interpretation of it, and then we're kind of stuck in it. So, as I said earlier, I wrote a fairly short science fiction novel, and I'll tell you why I wrote it in a minute, but before that I'm going to tell you a little bit about the cover. It's also on my shirt, and it's on Matt's shirt. So if you look at the cover of the book on the back, there's a watercolor painting that I did some years ago. And I took the watercolor painting and I gave it to a young friend of mine and asked him, I told him about a spiritual vision that I had had, and I asked him if he would illustrate the vision on top of my watercolor. And so this is what he came up with. And so that was a couple of years ago. And the reason I like this as the cover is because I consider the color picture on the back to be a representation of the sort of energetic dynamics of the universe. And this illustration as one example of a paradigm that would overlay those energetic patterns. And I could give him the same watercolor, tell him a different vision, have him illustrate that, and you'd have the same underlying color pattern, but now with a different illustration on it. And so I use that as a pictorial representation of how I see paradigm shifting. And then it just so happens that a couple of years later, about a year ago, I decided to write a science fiction novel. And the priestess from my vision a couple of years before found her way into the novel. So then I decided that my friend's picture was a perfect cover for this novel, which of course begs the question, is that just a coincidence? Or did she appear in the vision because she wanted to have a novel written about her? Right? So I would want to tell you that someone like Jeffrey Kripal, he's a professor at Rice University who happens to be one of my current intellectual heroes, who wrote a book called Mutants and Mystics, among others. He would tell you that it's quite possible that she wanted to have a novel written about her because she wanted to be brought more deeply into reality. That her existence in the non-material, unmanifest realm was becoming less than satisfactory, and so she started to feel for an author who would be available to write her story to bring her more into manifestation. Jeffrey Kripal has written numerous books. This one is very fun. He's also written a book called Authors of the Impossible. And Authors of the Impossible is a fairly long, somewhat academic explanation of exactly the process I just told you, in which he talks about the possibility that future realities are sort of existing in unmanifest realms of being, looking for an author or an artist to manifest them, which would begin the process of their being birthed into a more concrete reality. So I have decided in my work to talk about such people as artists of possibility, and essentially everything that I do is devoted to gathering a group of artists of possibility who want to work together to support each other and hone their ability to bring into manifestation possibilities that don't yet exist. So there, that's full disclosure on the evening. This is super fun, and we'll get to a bunch of that. Another book that's fed a lot into tonight is this book, which I've only recently started reading, called Lost Knowledge of the Imagination. It's by an author named Gary Lachman. Gary Lachman is interesting because how many of you know the rock band Blondie? He was the bass player for Blondie, but he's also an esotericist, and he's written, oh my God, 25 books or something, all about different esoteric individuals, a lot of biographies, or just about movements. In this one, he's writing about a very similar, he's plumbing a very similar vein as Jeffrey Kripal, essentially saying that there is an alternative way of knowing that has a long history in the human species, in our culture, but has in the last few hundred years been all but sort of pushed to the very edges of culture. And we'll get into all that too. So these are all previews of coming events. And I wrote some notes for this. I never do this, but I woke up this morning and I had like a whole thing in my head and I had to just get up and write it. So I will occasionally look. Because it helps me, because it reminds me of what I actually wanted to talk about, none of which is included in what I just said. So, what I was going to start with was my book. This is a novel called Transdimensional Crossing. And I have, for the last 3 years, taught a philosophy course, an 8-month philosophy course. And the people who take that course are asked to do a project. And the project is supposed to be some kind of articulation of new paradigm thinking. So this year, that course just ended literally 2 weeks ago. This year, my project was to write a novel. And so I started it in October, and I wrote it very specifically, stream of consciousness. So that means that I sat down every day. I didn't start with any story in mind. I did have kind of an opening scene in my head when I started, which happened to have been some experience I'd had years ago. And so I just started writing out that scene, and then I just kept writing and just seeing where it went. And the hope was that something interesting would happen. That was the idea. And the reason why I was considering this to be a new paradigm project is because of beliefs that I have, which is that when you work spontaneously, things can come through you that are not coming from your mind, which means they haven't been prefabricated by the current paradigm. So the way our thinking tends to work is that most of our thoughts that we hold consciously are like prefab houses. You know, they come more or less in the right pieces, and then you can construct a certain number of houses with those pieces and no others. So in a similar way, when you're using the thinking of the current paradigm, it can sort of be arranged in a certain number of ways and not others. But many people have explored the possibility of spontaneous works in which you're bypassing your conscious mind so that something else can come through. A very famous one in the 20th century would be the artist Jackson Pollock, who would just, you know, he had these huge canvases on the floor, and he would just walk all around with a paintbrush. But, you know, what you might not know about Jackson Pollock is it's not like he just walked into his studio and splashed paint around and then called it a, you know, $1 million piece of art. He would actually go in and sit for days sometimes and wait until something moved him and then do all that. So there was a real process to that work. So, you know, people look at it and then they think, well, you know, anybody can splash paint, which is true. Anybody can splash paint. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be splashing paint from the same space and consciousness that he was splashing paint from when he did it. Which, if we get to it tonight, will bring us to some thoughts about Goethe and some of the beginnings of this idea of spontaneity and imagination. I was more inspired by William James, the American psychologist, and his brother, Henry James, who were very interested in this kind of spontaneity as a means of connecting with higher intelligence, you know, what they would call the absolute. And you may or may not know that their spontaneous practice was inhaling nitrous oxide. So nitrous oxide is laughing gas. And if you inhale it in like a big gulp, which evidently is what they did, you pass out. And so they had a whole little setup. They did it standing in front of their bed, probably leaning back slightly, so that when they ingested, did they hold their breath? And they pass out. So the idea was when you pass out on nitrous oxide, it just obliterates your conscious mind. This was the theory. William James actually wrote a paper about this, the something effects of nitrous oxide. And so you pass out, and then you come back. You know, you don't pass out for very long, and then you come back. So there, and then when they came back, they had a desk set up with a notebook and a pen. And the theory was, when you're coming back from your trip to the absolute, they would write down as fast as they could the first things that came to their mind. And they thought that whatever that was maybe going to come from God, you know, or from the absolute. And supposedly they filled up dozens of notebooks this way. And the vast majority of it was completely nonsensical, not even necessarily in words. There's one famous line which James said was the one line that had some kind of, and I don't think I can remember it off the top of my head, but it has to do with something like, there is no difference except the difference between varying degrees of difference among differences or something. It was barely intelligible, but, you know, it did seem to say something. So they gave up on that. But James never gave up on the automatic writing. He always felt like there was a way that this spontaneous writing would allow access to something different. And when he was a professor later at Harvard in the psychology department, he also taught at Radcliffe, which was the women's sister college to Harvard. And he taught psychology there, and he ran psychology laboratories because he was very much part of the process of trying to turn psychology into something like a science. And one of his students was Gertrude Stein. And she was part of these spontaneous writing exercises, which she didn't totally buy. But later, as an expat living in Paris and working with writers like James Joyce, she really encouraged him to use spontaneous writing when he wrote Ulysses in order, in the same way, for something more creative to occur. And so I knew all that. I also knew some of the things that Jeffrey Kripal says about what can come through your novel. So I was inspired to do this spontaneous writing. So I'd go every day, write whatever I wrote, go the next day, continue on. Sometimes I'd have to miss a week because I was busy or something was happening. And then I'd go back and write. I never wrote for more than 2 hours a day. And I never went back and reread anything more than I absolutely had to. So if I came back after a week and I literally had no idea where I left off, then I'd go back a couple of pages so I could remember. Otherwise, it was really going to be an interesting novel. But besides that, I never went back and read anything. I finished it, and I sent it to a friend of mine and asked if she would do a light copy edit, and then she found things like some of the characters' names changed halfway through and things like that, which you don't notice if you're not going back to read, that you used a different name today than you did yesterday. But she figured it all out. And she said, no, basically it's coherent. You know, she got it to a place where she felt like it was coherent. And then I sent it to two people to proofread, and they agreed that it was coherent, and they found a lot of proofing mistakes. And then they sent it back to me, and I just printed it in this form. And I have never read it. So I don't know if I'm ever going to read it, because I'm kind of into the fact that I haven't read it. And you know, when I talk about it, I do go back, and I there are a few places I remember. So like tonight, I'm going to read you something, but I had to go back and find it. And then I look, sometimes I just look at a random page and read it and go, oh my God, I have no memory of writing that. Like, I can't believe I said that. So, what's that?
Really?
Absolutely. So I wanted to start with a little reading of, because I'd written about 86 pages. You know, I was hoping something was, this is like me. I'm always doing experiments of various types, hoping something's going to happen. You know, so for years it was spiritual practice, and now it's writing practice. But I was like, hope something happens. So I was writing as spontaneous as I could. I wasn't going back every day. And on page 86, something happened that was amazing. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what happens on page 86. So there's two characters in a train. One's name is Melinda, one's name is Jack. And they meet and they're having a conversation. And then at some point, she just stops. So that's where we're going to pick up the story. At this point, she stopped and it seemed like she feared she'd already said too much. Anyway, you get the idea, she finished weakly. She didn't seem to want to talk anymore. She said she needed to read for a class, and she opened a book that looked like a science textbook. We sat side by side for the next couple of hours without saying anything. I gotta go. This is my stop, she finally said. She got up and headed down the aisle, pushing past a few people as she did. I looked around and saw that we were in Providence, so it was my stop too. I gathered up my stuff and turned toward the exit of the train. As I did, I saw her just stepping off the train and onto the platform. And my mouth opened wide. My stomach turned. As she stepped off the train, her body twisted and her sweater pulled off her shoulder. And on her shoulder, I saw the very same fucking tattoo of a snake's head that Toby had. Excuse me, I said briskly as I pushed my way out of the train. I was being way too rough, but I just ignored all the dirty looks. I had to get to her. I had to find out if it really was the same tattoo. And if it was, I had to know where she got it and why. Hey, stop, I shouted. I need to ask you something. She looked back over her shoulder and started walking faster. Then, as if she thought better of it, she stopped. That's where something amazing happened. The reason is because when I was I was like getting really into it, and I was typing, and Toby was walking, and he was after her, and I was thinking, okay, great, I'm going to have her run off into the crowd, and the whole rest of the chapter is going to be this incredible through the streets of Providence chase, you know, and I was telling my fingers, type that she runs into the crowd, but my fingers typed, then, as if she thought better of it, she stopped, and I said, oh, shit, now what do I do? That wasn't what was supposed to happen. So I just kind of decided to go on and end the chapter quick because I didn't know what to do next. So I said, can I see your tattoo? I asked. As I got close to her, she looked like she was about to cry. You were in my dreams, she said. You were there, she admitted as she pulled her shirt down below her shoulder, revealing the very same tattoo that Toby had. I didn't realize it when I first sat down, but just as the train pulled up to the station, I saw an expression on your face, and I remembered you from my dreams. I haven't had one in over a year, but I remember them like they were yesterday. You were there. I thought it was over, but it's not. She pulled up her shirt and pointed with her finger to show me how the snake's body wrapped in coils down her back. I didn't say anything. I just looked, gaping. I pointed to her right ankle, and she pulled up her right pant leg and showed me where the snake's tail came to an end. It was exactly the same tattoo. "Do you know this tattoo?" she asked. "Yeah, I recently met someone who had the exact same one." There were tears streaming down her face now, and I felt so close to her. She looked different now. She was so beautiful and 10 or 20 years younger. I knew her. She wasn't a stranger. "We had to talk. We have to talk. Let's find a place nearby, and then I have to go see Dr. Reynolds with you." I looked around and pointed to a coffee shop. "Let's go there." And that was the end of the chapter. So I was out of my dilemma, which was I didn't know what was going to happen next. But how does that happen? How can you be telling your fingers to type one thing, and then they actually type something else? You know, and how it appeared to me is that the story, it was what I said at the time was the characters have, you know, they're rebelling against me, and they have a life of their own. But somehow I started to feel like the story had a momentum. And from that point in the story on, the writing was just an effortless flow. I hardly had to think anymore. I just had to type. It was like as long as my fingers were typing, stuff was going to come through. And that's why a lot of this I look at, I don't remember what it was, because I wasn't really thinking about it while I was writing it. And I thought, wow. As a spiritual teacher, what an amazing metaphor for the story of our ego, of our personality, that actually has its own agenda and its own momentum. And if we don't think much, it will just perpetuate itself through time. And so I got really fascinated by that, and I started to think about all the things I've been reading in Jeffrey Kripal. And starting to put together the possibility that writing and science fiction in particular and spiritual awakening have so much more in common than what I have ordinarily imagined. So I want to ask you now by show of hands, how many of you have had a paranormal experience? And you know, when we think of paranormal experiences, we tend to think of UFO abductions. These are the things I wrote down. We're on the next thing that I said I was going to talk about. UFO abductions, which I've never had. Seeing ghosts, which I have had. Voices of deities. You know, that's the things we tend to think about. But what if we extend the definition of paranormal to include deja vu experiences, just that weird moment when you meet somebody and you know you know them, but you don't know how. And times when you either had a dream or a thought about something that then actually happened later in some way. If you extend it to the definition of paranormal to mean any experience that can't be easily explained by our current scientific paradigm, then how many people have had a paranormal experience, right? Then pretty much anyone, more or less, would have one. So if we think about paranormal experiences, but then we want to talk about spiritual experiences, what's the difference? And I want to say there's not much difference, really. But I would want to say that a spiritual experience is any experience that connects you with a power higher than yourself, higher than your personal will. So what I experienced in that moment of writing, I would call a spiritual experience, and it felt like a spiritual. It felt like, holy shit, what just happened? Who just did that, right? So whenever you have this experience of something occurring that you can't explain, there's this feeling of like, oh my God, that's bizarre. That wasn't me that did that. Something happened through me that wasn't me. And so that's how I want to define a spiritual experience. Now, what Gary Lachman is writing about and what Jeffrey Kripal writes about quite a bit is how with the dawn of the scientific revolution and the age of enlightenment, a new kind of knowing emerged in the human population. And it was a knowing that was deeply mathematical, that strove to take experienced phenomena and define it in terms of mathematics so that it could be more precisely understood and studied. It was a way of knowing that relied very heavily on creating models about reality to understand things. And it was immediately in competition with other ways of knowing. And so the classic battle for the mind of Western culture was the difference between Goethe, who I mentioned earlier, who was a German poet and one of the originators of the Romantic Revolution, and Sir Isaac Newton, who was an English scientist. And Newton had developed a theory of color. And his theory of color is the one that's accepted. It's the one that we all use. There's a certain spectrum of color that we know of as in the rainbow. And Newton realized that those colors all represent different wavelengths of light. So a wave of a certain length is going to be red. A wave of a different length is going to be yellow, et cetera, et cetera. If you understand that that's what's going on, you can then take a red wave and a yellow wave and on a graph mathematically put them together, and you can see what the new wave is going to be like, and you can predict what color is going to be next. So you can know what's going to happen. If you take yellow and green and put them together, you can safely say what's going to be the color. It works great. It's amazing. People were very excited about it. Goethe was not excited. And, you know, Goethe... Sure. Goethe said, no, this is not the direction we want to go. We do not want to remove ourselves from reality by creating this sort of mathematically modeled view of everything that, and then engage with the mathematical view rather than with the actuality of our experience. And so Goethe said, well, I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to create a different color theory. And he created his own color theory, which had to do with, and I don't understand his theory well enough to really give you a good sense, but essentially it has to do with how colors, with when you inject darkness behind them and light in front, will change. And his color theory worked perfectly well. It didn't rely on any idea about waves or mathematics. It only relied on taking different colored bits and putting them together and looking at them. And he said, this is the way we should do science. We should do science by actually looking at things rather than by mathematically modeling everything. He went to Italy and had this profound experience in Italian gardens where he saw the essence of plant. And he developed this way of doing science in which he said, the way we should do science is not by modeling things. What we should do is you get into a certain wide open consciousness in which you are communing with something, and then you look at it, and you keep looking at it, and if you look at it long enough, it will reveal itself to you as an intuitive insight about its essence and its nature. And then he wrote a whole book about the essence of plants and everything he'd learned from the plants by listening. So it sounds very shamanistic. And he was saying, this is the way we should do science. This is real science. Real science has to do with actually connecting with things and then allowing them to reveal themselves rather than distancing yourself from things and then modeling them so they work. In that, difference of opinion, Newton, hands down, won. Everybody went with Newton. Nobody went with Goethe. Goethe's scientific papers ended up in a closet in I think the University of Freiburg or somewhere where he was teaching. Basically, for 100 years, no one even looked at the boxes. They only came out, and some of you probably know this, but they only came out about 100 years later when there was some young graduate student, and they said, hey, we got all these boxes of Goethe's papers. You know, can you go sort through those and see if there's anything valuable in there? Because everyone thought, well, Goethe's science was just useless, so just leave it in the closet. And this graduate student started reading these papers and was like, oh, my God. This is amazing, all this stuff about opening yourself. And he got so excited, he cataloged all the stuff, and then he wrote his own book. He wrote a couple of books, actually, sort of based on this, and then it became the basis of his whole life and his whole teaching, and that graduate student is Rudolf Steiner, who became very famous as a mystic and an esotericist later. So what Gary Lachman is saying is that there was this way of knowing, and Goethe is one example of that, but there are many others, in which, so he calls it the knowledge of imagination. There was a knowledge of how we could use our imagination in a way. See, what happened in the Enlightenment was the idea of imagination became that imagination is just pure fantasy. So post the Enlightenment, you have fact and fiction. And fiction is just books that don't really matter except for their, you know, except for their aesthetic quality, except for the beauty of them and the beauty of the writing, and maybe some messages that are hidden in there, but they aren't about things that are real. They're about fantasy. Samuel Taylor Coleridge was very inspired by Goethe, very also interested in this idea of some kind of realm of imagination, which is not just pure fantasy, it's not just stuff you make up. It's actually feeling into pre-conscious realms of existence. And then by allowing yourself to feel, using your imagination to feel into those, you allow them to illuminate themselves. And then when you create your art or you do your writing, you're giving them more body in the manifest realm. And by doing that, you're allowing them to be seen by more and more people until eventually they become common. So this is a lot what Jeffrey Kripal's writing about. He's saying, in the 20th century, it becomes so incredibly unfathomable. There is no safe place for people to share mystical or esoteric wisdom. There just is no place left. It's as he says himself, you know, he told me in a phone conversation, as a professor of religion in the humanities, I really can't write what I think. Because if I write what I think, I'll be out of here. So what I do is I decided to write books about the history of religion, and then I find historical figures who believe what I believe, so then I can write what I think without having to take credit for it. And then I can get my books published, and I can get the ideas out, but I don't have to be ridiculed by my peers, which he actually is ridiculed quite a bit by his peers. But he's been at this for 25 years, he wrote a very seminal book on the history of Esalen, the center in California, that was incredibly respected and well-received, and he got tenure, and so now he's kind of free to do anything he wants to do. He recently published a book which he co-wrote with Whitney Strieber, I think that's his name, who's famous for his UFO books and abductions, and they co-authored a book together. So clearly he's pretty free to do what he wants to do at the moment. I mean, he also did do Mutants and Mystics, which I'm sure you have to be fairly well established to get away with it. So what he said was in the 20th century, because there was a very concerted effort on the part of science to establish itself as the only, as this kind of sole storehouse for truth. And so there was an effort to make sure that all other ways of knowing, all of the quote-unquote paranormal ways of knowing, all of the psychic ways of knowing, all of the intuitive ways of knowing, were just looked at as woo-woo, not worth consideration, not worth... And there was a long, you know, Kripal and Lachman kind of go into a sort of a long history where science, as a paradigm, was working to establish itself. And so, and what happens, of course, is as it becomes established, and of course, look, the scientific paradigm is amazing, and life was so much better. It was getting so much better so quickly. Who the heck is going to want to stop that? And so eventually in universities, you can't really get funding unless you're a science. And so then there was this rush for all the humanities to try to be more scientific. This is what Kreipe will talk about. So as a, you know, he's a religion professor, but he's really a historian of religion professor, because history is a little bit more scientific than just religion. And then he said in the humanities, you kind of have to either do critique or comparison. Because if he started writing his own spiritual views, that would be considered non-academic, not worthy of any print. So this other way of knowing was all but sort of, it just got pushed out to the edges. It got pushed out to the sides. And so in the 20th century, what this book is about, and some specifically, is Kreipe did this study and realized that science fiction authors and comic book authors, in many cases, were essentially mystics who had no other place to write. Because their mystical insights wouldn't be accepted anywhere else, they just wrote them into their fiction instead of, you know, they could have become New Age authors, but evidently, you know, they didn't find that the right route. They were probably afraid to be labeled crazy. So nobody thinks comic book authors are crazy. And no matter what you write, it seems perfectly valid for a comic book. And so in this book, there's amazing story after story after story of the profound mystical and esoteric experiences of these authors and how they both inspired their writing and inspire their characters, and inspire the superpowers that their characters have, et cetera. And one of the authors in the story is Philip K. Dick, whom some of you may know, is a science fiction author from the 60s, and had always been a favorite of mine. If you haven't read Philip K. Dick, it's definitely worth reading, but you've probably heard of some of his films, or some films that were made of his work. So Blade Runner was originally a Philip K. Dick story. Minority Report was a Philip K. Dick story. Total Recall, Scanner Darkly, and there's a few others. And you know what, I used to want to like Philip K. Dick when I was younger, but somehow it was a little over my head. I was really into it. You know, like I loved, but I didn't get it. And now that I go back and read it, I could see why I didn't get it. I was never going to get it. So, but I was entranced by it. So Dick, he wrote feverishly, largely on amphetamines, I've heard, because he used to like to write as close to 24 hours a day as possible. And his he's famed for having written 7 novels in 1 year. And later in his life, he wrote an enormous a number of novels, something like 30 or 40, and tons of short stories. Later in his life, he had this very powerful, very bizarre spiritual experience. And so the experience was someone came to his door. He went to the door, opened the door. I can't remember who it was. I actually think it was someone selling cookies, like a Girl Scout, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But it was definitely a woman, and she had one of those sort of Christian fish necklaces that she was wearing. And he noticed that symbol. And I think the way it goes is he noticed this symbol. It was a little metal necklace. And he said, a pink laser beam from a satellite hit the necklace and bounced into his head. And when it hit him in the head, it gave him total knowledge of the universe. And which sounds bizarre and funny, except the next thing that happened is he realized that his 3-year-old or 4-year-old son had a disease a deadly disease that was going to kill him in about a week. And so he took the son to the hospital, and he said, and he didn't know what the name of the disease was, but he described to the doctors, you need to look here, exactly what it was. The doctor said, no, that's so rare, that never happens. You just don't worry, you just imagine. And he said, no, I know it's true. So finally they said, okay, we'll examine him. And they came back and they said, I can't believe it. You were totally right. And if we hadn't done some operation, he wouldn't have lasted a week. So that would help you believe that whatever happened, as bizarre as it seems, had some validity to it. And so Philip K. Dick had this light beam to his head that gave him total knowledge. The light beam, he thought, came from a satellite called VALIS, which is like vast something living intelligence system. He ended up writing a book called VALIS, which was part of a trilogy, science fiction trilogy. He finished the second book of the trilogy, but I think he died before he ever wrote the third. I think the book VALIS, if I was going to recommend to you to read any Philip K. Dick, that is just an amazing story. And it includes the story of getting hit in the head, in a fictional version. But what happened after that was, and this was something that I knew when I started my novel, it was part of what inspired me to write spontaneously, is he began to realize, as he was having these visions of all knowledge, right? He was an obsessive character. He started writing an exegesis. An exegesis is a Christian term, which is essentially an explanation of spiritual knowledge. And he started writing it every night, probably on amphetamines. And he would write for hours and hours and hours and hours. And what he started to realize is that in his novels, there were messages from this vast intelligence embedded in his novels that he had written without knowing those messages were in there. And so he went back, part of what he did is he went back, reread all of his novels to pull out all of the secret messages. And, if you read his exegesis, the first 1,000 pages was just published about a year ago. And if you read them, it's all full of his kind of angst around, oh my God, I see this, and there's pages of him being excited about it, then pages of him thinking he's crazy, then more pages of being excited, and then more pages of him thinking he's crazy. So he was definitely in a little bit of a battle with all this. They said he wrote over 10,000 pages of an exegesis before he died. No one until recently has ever tried to compile them, and the first 1,000 pages they just published. I've read about 300 pages. It's pretty hard to read. it's fascinating at first, but then it's like, oh my God, am I going to read 10,000 pages of this? That's a lot of pages. Thank you. But the through line that I want to make through all of this, and kind of what, there's a chapter on Philip K. Dick in this book, and somehow Philip K. Dick was entering into some kind of, what is now, wasn't known this way when Goethe was writing, but is now sometimes talked about as an imaginal realm. An imaginal realm is a realm that exists somewhere between pure fantasy and what we think of as pure concrete reality. And he was somehow able to enter into an imaginal realm and pull things out. And what's fascinating, really, is if you read his novels, or if you see the movies like Minority Report, they don't look like novels that were written 60 years ago. They have very today themes. He was really, he was never that accepted in America. He was really revered in Europe. Europeans, continental Europeans, loved his work and really recognized him as a great author long before he was ever recognized in America as a great author. But somehow, what Kripal brings up is the possibility that he was entering into this kind of imaginal realm, and he was feeling into possibilities that didn't yet exist, and then bringing them more fully into being in his writing. And that bringing them into being is part of what made them more real, which is what they helped guide. They were a contributing factor to guiding our culture in a direction where now they feel like today. They feel relevant today, even though they seemed kind of too weird for most people at the time. And this is just a domain that I like, Gary Lachman and Jeffrey Kripal and others that I'm kind of associated with and reading. It feels like a necessary move out of the current paradigm, is a move away from this, the currently accepted belief. So in the current scientific paradigm, what we're taught is that the universe is a pre-existent place essentially made up of facts. And then scientists discover facts. So the idea is, if we were all to disappear and there was nobody left in the universe would still be there and all the facts would remain exactly the way they were. Goethe and these authors and others are saying, that's not really the way reality works. Maybe. Maybe reality isn't a place that exists completely independent of us, that's just there full of facts waiting to be discovered. Maybe reality is something that's emerging as we recognize it. Now, quantum mechanics, which I spoke about a few months ago, would tend to confirm that, right? The Heisenberg's uncertainty principle basically tells you that you know, a thing isn't what it is until it's seen as that. A light wave is not either a wave or a particle until it's observed, and at that moment it becomes a wave or a particle. That's what those experiments would tell you. And as I said a few months ago, the author Robert Lanza, who's written on quantum theory, to me, his big gripe is, I can't believe these experiments have been around for 100 years and nobody's doing anything about it. Like, we're still going on as if we live in a universe of facts when we seem to have experimental results that prove that this is not the case. And this goes to show you just how powerful the dominant paradigm is, because even when science comes up with an alternative, it sort of gets relegated to the sidelines. And so we need to, I believe, shift our experience of reality. And it's going to be hard to do. So it's a little bit like the experiment, the little meditation I took you through in the beginning. To go from seeing things one way to another way is going to be difficult, because we are deeply entrenched in this way of seeing. And our culture conditions us to continue to see it by threatening us if we see things differently. But it's really important that we learn to see things differently. So in terms of the foundations of reality, I want to just take a minute to give you a way to think about it that may give you greater access, which is, we have been trained to define reality as that which pre-exists us, that which is already there, and that which will be there when we're gone. That's what's real. That's what's really real, right? So in our rush for objectivity, we've separated ourselves from reality. What if we think about it differently? And I'm using as a model one of my favorite philosophers, Charles Sanders Peirce. So what if we think about it as this? There are things that exist that are independent of us, right? Because we don't want to go into something that's purely subjective, which means, you know, I'm creating everything, because that has problems. So what if we say, yes, there are things that exist. There is a whole, this underlying, as I said earlier, this underlying energetic dynamic does exist. There is a reality that exists independent of the observer. But that that existence, we'll call it existence, is not real. It doesn't become reality until it's experienced. So even though there may be things that exist independent of being observed, they don't get to count as reality until they're observed. If there's something that exists that literally no being anywhere could ever possibly see, then we're saying that's not real. Now, you could argue and say it's still real, doesn't matter if anybody anywhere, that would be a different preference. But I want you to consider the possibility that we define reality as being experienced, that existent things, when they're experienced, become real. And that's a lot what these authors are saying, and what Goethe was saying, and what Coleridge was saying, and all kinds of other people were saying, that reality, the only reality that really matters, the reality that's really real, is an experienced reality. An experience is not just a passive observation of something that already exists. It's an active, co-creative process. And I just think if we keep thinking of our, if we keep embracing that possibility, and then we experiment with things like meditation or spontaneous writing, and we try to let ourselves go a little, maybe we'll discover that it's true. Maybe we'll discover that a story like this science fiction novel is not just a collection of ideas that I created in my head. Maybe there's something that wanted to find its way into a book that worked with me, coaxing me, sending me the inspiration I needed until I got to a place where I said, damn it, I'm going to sit down for 8 months and just write you because you're bothering me. And so the whole point here tonight is we don't live in a culture that is friendly to a different way of relating to imagination, and a culture that's friendly to the idea that maybe reality isn't just a place of facts that sits there. But we all in this room have said that we have some experience, however small it might be, that says there might be more to reality than what we're taught. And so I'm just wanting to create a gaping hole for you to run through and explore alternate possibilities in whatever way you feel inspired to explore them, and to know that there's a history to back it up. Because one of the things a dominant paradigm will do always, and this doesn't matter if it's a political dominant paradigm or in this case an ontological dominant paradigm, but it will try to erase the history of its alternatives, which is why when you had slavery, one of the things you want to do is make sure you erase the history. Or if you want a male-dominated society, you try to erase the history of women because you don't want that group, that not dominant group, to have the power of history. And so the history that these professors are bringing out, a history that goes back hundreds of years, that was actually richly explored in various means and is now finding its way into science fiction and comic books, is a history that we as artists of possibility can draw strength from. And you know, there is going to be a part of all of us that worries, oh my God, this is too weird, I'm going to be considered too weird. People will say that to me. I mean, I'm kind of over that because at this point, pretty much besides the people that like me, everybody else thinks I'm weird. So it's like I have not really that much to lose. But my feeling is when I look at the way the world is, I think risking being weird is really not the worst thing that could happen right now. You know, I mean, it looks to me like things need to change so much, a little weirdness might be okay. So that's everything I wanted to say tonight. I am happy to take a few questions if there are any, and then we have snacks and drinks, and I hope all this landed in a place that's inspiring and fun and interesting. So, thank you. What's that? If you're on Zoom, we have people visiting us from other places. If you're on Zoom and you have a question, you can just type it in and Tara will read it.
is going to be at the Jacob Burns Wednesday night.
Okay. The original, not the new one. Okay. It's a fantastic film. I mean, okay, since you brought it up, it's not really a question, but I'll throw it in anyway. Who, it was Ridley Scott, right, was the director? So I remember reading once that he made the actors stay in their wet clothes all the time so that they would be so agitated that the film would have that angst that it has. And I, when I heard that, I thought, oh, that is really amazing, because you can feel it in the movie. Every character feels like they're sort of on the edge of having a fight. So that's great. Thank you for letting us know that. Anything, Tara?
Jeff, I wanted to say that Newton is known for his mathematics, but he was actually also a practicing alchemist.
He was, that is true.
He just kept it hidden.
He kept it hidden, and so did the rest of science.
Practicing what?
Alchemist. Newton was a practicing alchemist. But since you said that, it reminds me, this is my friend Shelley, and next Sunday we're doing a workshop, a writing workshop, in which hopefully some of the ideas that we talked about today will manifest as an opportunity to explore writing from a different place. What's that?
Can you repeat
the comment? Oh, which comment? Oh, Shelley's comment was that although Isaac Newton is best known as the father of modern science and for his mathematics, he was also a practicing alchemist at the time. That's less known and not what he became famous for. And I use that as an opportunity to introduce Shelley as a friend with whom I'm going to do a workshop next Sunday involving writing from a different place. And great, so I think we did it. Thank you very much for coming. There's treats and drinks for you all, and I hope you'll stick around for a few minutes and say hello. Thank you.